Good afternoon, and welcome to the annual Radcliffe Day Luncheon. Welcome alumni, alumni, fellows and former fellows, members of the Institute and Harvard communities, and friends old and new. We are delighted to have you with us today. It is thrilling to end Radcliffe Institute's 10th anniversary year with capacity-filling attendance at both our morning panel and this luncheon. Please welcome back to Radcliffe Yard, President Drew Faust, and please join me in extending a very warm welcome to Radcliffe Institute medalist Gloria Steinem. Thank you all so much for coming. I would like to recognize our most senior alumni here today. Would members of the classes of 1936, 1938, and 1939 please stand? Please join me also in a special expression of gratitude to the past presidents and executive directors of the Radcliffe College Alumni Association. Would you please stand? Many Radcliffe College alumni and past Bunting Fellows who are no longer with us cherish this day. In their memory, I ask that you join me in a moment of silence. Thank you. As I look out today, I'm pleased to see among us a strong group of alumni marking their 50th Radcliffe College reunion, the class of 1960. Many of us remember what it was like to be a young woman in that era, when much cultural currency was attached to your homemaking and child-rearing skills and little to your intellect. You succeeded against great odds. You excelled academically. You set out into new terrain in your professions. You cut paths to new ways of thinking, new ways of seeing, and new ways of achieving. We applaud you. I see in this audience many pioneers. You hail from different eras, you have experienced Radcliffe in different ways, and yet you share core values and motivating principles. Values and principles that once drove Radcliffe College and that drive Radcliffe Institute today. Breaking barriers, defying expectations, intellectual exploration, academic innovation, inclusiveness, diversity, risk, and change. Together, we celebrate this legacy. The Radcliffe Institute was built on the shoulders of Radcliffe College. In fact, without Radcliffe College's extraordinary history of excellence and enterprise, the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study would not exist. I want to honor all of you who, by your performance as students, demonstrated that women's place in academia is at the top. I salute those who, in your personal and professional lives, have continued to defy limits, break molds, become leaders. And I thank you for your continuing vital support of the Radcliffe Institute, where your legacy flourishes and expands. Without your vision, commitment, and generosity, our success would not be possible. Throughout this past year, many of you have joined us in celebrating the Institute's first decade. And what a decade it has been. We have promoted intellectual inquiry at the frontiers of knowledge, convened great minds, and provided unique opportunities for people of diverse backgrounds and interests to come together to learn, discover, and make the world better. Through the Radcliffe Fellowship Program, Schlesinger Library, and academic engagement programs, we have been a catalyst for groundbreaking research and cross-disciplinary collaborations. Through our seminars, workshops, conferences, and symposia, we have helped cross boundaries between Harvard schools and between disciplines. Some boundary crossings have been of a more theoretical kind, the boundary between number theory and wave mathematics, for example. Others of a more physical or experimental kind, for instance, finding commonalities in nature between the deep sea and outer space, or connections between Martha Graham's Lamentations and Islamic veiling. We have brought some of the world's top scientists, humanists, social scientists, and artists to the Institute and to the Harvard faculty. Just this year, the Radcliffe Alumni Professorship, to which many of you contributed, helped the Harvard Mathematics Department attract its first tenured woman. A second Radcliffe professorship assisted the law school in appointing a distinguished Pulitzer Prize-winning legal historian. And just yesterday, Harvard awarded an honorary degree for pioneering scientific research to 2007-08 Institute Fellow Susan Lindquist, who is with us here today. We have also engaged the public with numerous programs that celebrate the life of the mind and the world of ideas. On the back of your program, right here, you'll find information about some of the exciting programs planned for next year. We encourage you to join us. Please mark your calendars and plan on coming. This, after all, is your legacy, and for it, you have our admiration, our deep respect, and our gratitude. Breaking barriers, defying expectations, and crossing boundaries are also characteristics of the Radcliffe Medalist we honor today. Gloria Steinem has had a lasting impact on women's rights in the home, in the workplace, in political spheres, in this nation, and around the world. She is admired by so many that she makes frequent appearances on most influential lists. And I lost count of the special requests for a ticket to this lunch or a seat near the front, each of which came with a story of a life affected by her work. Steinem once dreamed of tap dancing her way out of Toledo. Show business seemed like the only venue in which women were breaking the mold. Thanks to her feminist leadership, there are so many more opportunities today for so many women in so many places. Gloria Steinem graduated from Smith College, Phi Beta Kappa, and Magna Cum Laude in 1956 with a degree in government and a fellowship to study in India. There, she became acquainted with Gandhi's philosophy of nonviolent, direct action organizing, and the seeds of her activism were sown. On returning to the United States, she began a career as a freelance journalist and, as she puts it, an itinerant feminist organizer. In the late 1960s, Steinem co-founded and became a political columnist for New York Magazine, spoke out against the war in Vietnam, raised money for Cesar Chavez's farm workers movement, and stumped for liberal Democratic candidates. In March 1969, She went as a reporter to an unprecedented public speak out on abortion hosted by Red Stockings, a women's liberation group. For Steinem, witnessing the speaker's public testimony of their covert acts was a transforming moment. She left galvanized and newly focused on feminist causes. She became spokesperson, activist, relentless pursuer of fairness. In 1971, Steinem helped form the National Women's Political Caucus. The following year, she and other journalist activists took the courageous step of founding the first National Feminist Monthly magazine. Ms. sold out its 300,000 test copies in hardly a week. It received 20,000 reader letters in its first few months, letters so engaging and from so diverse an audience that they are now housed here at the Schlesinger Library as a record of the feminist movement and its effects on women from all walks of life. Ms. was and is, though, more than a magazine. Very soon after the publication's launch, Steinem and her colleagues created the Ms. Foundation for Women, a social justice organization. Among its myriad initiatives are Take Our Daughters to Work Day and the Katrina Women's Response Fund. For over four decades, Gloria Steinem's eloquence, her ability to disagree without demonizing, and her humor have made hers an important voice in the struggle for equality. Steinem's activism was global long before global was trendy. More than 30 years ago, she brought the practice of female genital mutilation to Americans' attention. And throughout her career, she has called for a feminism not limited by national boundaries. Steinem's activism has, though, also been very personal. She has promoted the work of younger feminists and offered many crucial support. Her home and heart are famous for welcoming in younger women as friends, as sisters, and as daughters. Throughout Steinem's years as a feminist leader, she has reminded us of what matters. In her own words, "There is no such thing as being individually free in the face of collective bias. There can be no big social change without words and phrases that first create a dream of change in our heads. If we want joy and music and friendship and laughter at the end of our revolution, we must have joy and music and friendship and laughter along the way. Whatever you want to do, do it now. There's no second like this one. Please join me in honoring our 2010 Radcliffe Institute medalist, Gloria Steinem. Can you come over on this side? I'm going to give you this, and I'm going to read what it says now. And then I'm going to put the medal around it. Gloria Steinem, you have chosen to make a difference, fighting bias wherever you see it. You have uttered words that frame the dream in many minds, brought laughter to the revolution, and seized the moment. Your legacy is a better world. You will always be with women and men anywhere they wrestle with injustice and inequality. Through your tireless pursuit of social justice, through your willingness to give of yourself, you have changed lives. We thank you, and it is our privilege to award you the Radcliffe Medal.
This is so much a day that I will never forget. And that was such an introduction to live up to. I'm definitely living to 100, but now I have to in order to live. It's really hard to know what to say on this kind of occasion. And, well, one thing is clear, that in the future, when I'm confused with Gertrude Stein, which I already am, actually, you know, if ever you think you're getting uppity, you know, I get letters addressed to Gertrude Stein. So I can be confident maybe that somebody in the future will look at this medal and say, well, we don't know who she was, but if she got this medal, she must have been okay. And I want to thank especially, I hope a lot of you were at the wonderful panel that we just had. Really, really great panel. And I thank so much all the participants and each of you here for giving of your time. Time is the greatest gift. Time is all there is. And coming here today means a very great deal. I have to say that being under this symbolic tent as a Smith graduate has a special meaning to me. And maybe this is a now it can be told kind of story. See what you think. I once imagined that Radcliffe and Smith could merge. After all, we share our historic mission, right? And it was a decade ago, and I had joined the board of Smith because, A, the great Ruth Simmons was Smith's president, and, B, I'd finally stopped being retroactively mad at Smith for the very non-feminist 1950s of my student days, which really wasn't their fault, you know? The 1950s were nobody's fault. I think it must have been 1990 or 1991, and the merger talks between Harvard and Radcliffe were on, and there were lots and lots of rumors. And it sounded to me, I'm quite willing to be wrong, but it sounded to me as if Radcliffe was sort of in the position of an abused woman trying to negotiate with her abusive husband. So Ruth Simmons and I decided that what Radcliffe needed was a girlfriend. And it actually happened that the always brave Ruth was willing to call one insider and see if we could raise the future possibility of a merger between Smith and Radcliffe. At a minimum, we thought we would give Radcliffe bargaining power. However, even if such a far-out possibility had been possible at all, it was way too late. So I'm touched to be at this merger today of me and Radcliffe under one big tent. And I'm very moved that we're here in a combination of people that has never happened before in exactly the same way, and will never happen again in exactly the same way. So, and with all five senses. I mean, I know that technology is great, but we have all five senses for a reason. So I'm hoping that all of us here might meet a new person, hear a new thing, find something together today in this community that changes our lives for the better the next day and the next. Now, actually, in thinking about today, there were so many things to say in a short time that I found myself reduced to making a top 10 list like David Letterman. For instance, 10, don't ever believe that men can't change. For most of my life, I was told that due to fine motor skills that only women had, only women could type. If you don't think so, look at Mad Men, those of you who are too young to remember this. Then suddenly computers appeared, and voila, men could type. The moral of this story is that we can change men and the world to fit women, not just women to fit men and the world. 9. All grown-ups should be able to get married as long as they don't hit each other. But I hope we stop thinking that only lifetime partnerships mean success. As Margaret Mead often pointed out, marriage worked better in the 19th century because people only lived to be 50. Now that we're living 3 decades longer and have our own paychecks, such as they are, some of us will marry early, raise children, and then go off to different lives. Others will marry late or not at all, or nurture people we didn't give birth to. And some of us are going to do all of the above serially. 8. Nobody prepares you for this, but former lovers become family. All the more so now that women like ourselves well enough to fall in love with people who like us as we are. Even at my age, I had the good luck to have a college fiancé who remained my friend, as did his daughters and at least one of his wives. When that wife asked me to speak at his funeral, though she wasn't going to speak herself, she said, quote, "I would be angry and inappropriate. You weren't married to him, you'll be fine." You can't make this up, right? It really am. At that moment, all of us were a family. 7. We've demonstrated to the American majority satisfaction that women can do what men can do, but we haven't convinced even ourselves that men can do what women do. Which is not so smart because, 6, nothing much is going to change until men are raising children as much as women are. Not only will women go right on having 2 jobs, which is impossible. Superwoman was created by anti-feminists who were trying to say that men don't have to do it all to have it all, but women somehow have to do it all to have it all. It means that female authority will seem appropriate to childhood and not to high places. True, every pioneer helps, from Shirley Chisholm to Hillary, but women won't be equal outside the home until men are equal inside the home. 5, all parents, men as well as women, need to get mad. This is the only modern democracy in the world without some national system of childcare, family-friendly work policies, actual sex education as opposed to the abstinence-only variety that we have, and yes, government health care. Get mad. Four, my generation of women thought that your life and your looks kind of went out the window when you were 30, and the demands of husband and children took over. It seems to me that this generation of young women in their 20s now think that life is over if success hasn't arrived by 30, right? So from the bottom of my heart, I want to say life gets greater and more surprising after 40, 50, 60, and yes, 70. Three, from nation states and national borders to gender, race, and even generations, all categories are fictions. Reality isn't about ranking, it's about linking. 2, Women got in this jam because our bodies are the means of reproduction, and various male-dominant systems control reproduction, or try to, and thus control us. The only way out is to establish reproductive freedom as a fundamental human right. Finally, something else you already know, and that is that everything we think of as a social justice movement, everything that's about balance with each other and nature, balance between self-authority and resistance to unjust authority, they are all connected. They are all one movement. Given the last election and the massive media effort to separate race and sex as if they were competitive, as if a big percentage of the country and more than half the world weren't affected by both, I put as number one the reason why they are inextricably intertwined. I don't mean to sound didactic here, and I'm afraid I'm leaving Letterman behind, but this is the only way I know to say it simply. To preserve any racial hierarchy, you need so-called racial purity, or at least visible difference. Therefore, females of the so-called superior group have to be controlled by men of that group. To preserve a supply of workers marked by race as cheap labor, women of color are more likely to be sexually exploited. So yes, there is a big difference in the way racism is lived by white women and by women of color in this country. But the past, present, and future truth is that racism punishes all women because our bodies are controlled in order to reproduce and maintain that racial difference. As a black suffragist said to her white suffragist sisters, a pedestal is as much a prison as any small space. And until we learn this, we will not have one true movement. Currently, it's still hidden in plain sight by calling what happens to men politics and what happens to women culture, or ignoring the not always conscious but existing coalition in which a racial voting gap favors gender equality and a gender gap favors racial equality. Imagine how that coalition could grow if we were not cynically divided, if it were truly named and supported. That's the end of my David Letterman list. However, it seemed to me that it was very much in the past and in the present. And I think we all form our habits of mind early. And maybe because I spent my teenage years trying to get out of Toledo, I live in the future. On my 75th birthday, for instance, a reporter asked me what I was most proud of in my life that I had done. And I said, well, I haven't done it yet. And he said, in this life? So I want to end with a few future reasons why the deep thinkers of the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study are going to be the source, why we need you as the source of transformative thought, why your unique advantage of making others see the world as if females mattered is exactly what we need. Indeed, if you keep to this original purpose, it could render all the other so-called tubs of Harvard, the business school, the law school, and yes, even the divinity school, a little boring. Why? Because Radcliffe will be dealing with causes and all the rest will be dealing with effects. For instance, in economics, we can't plan effectively in this country because caregiving in the home, which is an indispensable 30% of all productive work in this nation, whether it's for elderly parents or children, and, of course, it's done 90% by women. But all of this work has no attributed value. It could be valued at replacement level, made tax deductible for those who pay taxes and tax refundable for those below tax level, thus rewarding work and substituting for welfare. Such an attributed value for caregiving would make the national system of accounts reflect realities and would attribute and would be exceeded only by attributing an economic value to the environment. Now this is a project for a deep thinker of the Institute. We need you. For instance, in law, generally speaking, the law punishes the invasion of private property more surely than the invasion of our bodies. That's because we have the residue of a system in which some people were property, and also because rape was called sex instead of violence. Both women and men have a need for laws against bodily invasion, but since females suffer it more, we're more likely to establish a new legal principle that might be called bodily integrity. It could also protect against involuntary testing, DNA theft, and dangers within the organ transplant system. We need a deep thinker. For instance, in religion, why does God, whether Christian, Jewish, Muslim, or even Buddha, look like the ruling class? Why do we so rarely study cultures in which godliness resides in all living things? Why are religious structures so often built to resemble the body of a woman, with an outer entrance, an inner entrance, a central vaginal aisle, two curved ovarian structures on either side, think about it, and in the middle, the altar where the miracle takes place, where priests, dressed in skirts, sprinkle imitation birth fluid over our heads, give us a new name, and say something like, "You were born of woman, and therefore in sin, but if you obey the rule of the rules of the patriarchy, we men can give you everlasting life." I didn't make this up, you know. That's what. Perhaps Henry Breasted, the early 19th century scholar of Egypt as the birthplace of monotheism. And we should remember that monotheism probably didn't exist for the first 95% of human history. Perhaps he was right when he said, quote, "Monotheism is but imperialism in religion," unquote. God was withdrawn from females and from nature in order to justify conquering females and nature. The plot thins. For instance, striving to diminish the violence we can no longer afford on this fragile spaceship Earth is clearly a subject for a very deep thinker. One can directly predict the violence in a country, in its foreign policy, in its degree of reliance on the military, by the normalization of violence in the home. As Olof Palme, former chief of state of Sweden, said, "Gender roles are the deepest cause of violence, all violence other than that in direct self-defense. Thus, it is the deepest responsibility of every government in the world to humanize gender roles." Yet because family forms and child-rearing are so often feminine areas of study, and foreign policy and militarism are so often masculine fields, academia tends to divorce the cause from the effect. Radcliffe scholars can link them. Speaking of violence, we could continue the long journey towards untangling it from sexuality. As long as dominance and submission are sexualized, some men will be turned on by the helplessness of children. Only when mutuality, cooperation, and equality are sexualized will child abuse diminish and stop. But as I speak, the average age of entry into prostitution in this country is 13, and there are at least 3 million child prostitutes in India. We now know about sex trafficking, and that's important, but we must also know about the customers for sex trafficking. Then there's the question of how we study history, especially when we start. On this land, where you and I now sit, before Europeans first showed up. They observed, with shock, that, quote, these savages don't rape even their female prisoners, unquote. And they remarked with great disapproval that they also didn't beat their children. How could they possibly beat the devil out? So women were judged to be immoral because they controlled their own fertility. They chose the chiefs of their tribes and occasionally were the chiefs, and they otherwise disobeyed the patriarchal ways of the arriving Europeans. Is this what inspired European women to imagine equality and seek suffrage? We know they had dinner with Seneca women every Sunday night in upstate New York. We know they had constant contact. We know they wrote about each other. And yet, we don't hear this part of the history. My dear friend, Wilma Mankiller, the chief of the Cherokee Nation, who left us last month, often said, on this continent and on most continents, feminism is memory. Finally, we need you, we need you, we need the Radcliffe Institute and your thinkers to help us understand what is happening in our daily political lives. For instance, many people in this country are alarmed by the current throwing around of epithets like fascist and communist. We're alarmed by the big increase in arms sales and recruitment for racist and other extremist groups. We're alarmed by the first murder of an abortion doctor since the last time the ultra-right wing lost control of the White House and Congress during the Clinton administration. And we're alarmed by the vitriol directed at immigrants who simply do not have the proper papers. But because you and I, because this institute understands family violence, we can understand that all violence other that is not about financial or other gain is about proving superiority and control. Indeed, so many crimes should really be called supremacy crimes because that is their motive. For instance, we know that the time a woman is most likely to be beaten or killed, the time she is in greatest danger, is when she is leaving a violent home, when she is about to escape or has just escaped. Well, I submit to you that this country is escaping. Think about it. We're less likely to support foreign interventions, more likely to protest our big financial institutions, far less likely to create hierarchical families, deeply hostile to oil companies destroying the environment, and about to become a country in which European Americans are no longer the majority for the very first time. And we have elected a proud African American president and his family to the White House. This country is becoming free. Therefore, two things are true. Understanding the connections between home and political life, we know that this is, yes, a time of maximum danger, but we know that we have to be vigilant and protect each other. But just as we would never tell a woman to stay in a violent home, we will not stop seeking freedom either. It is those connections which you in this room, by looking at the world as if everyone mattered, it is those connections that you uniquely can make. It is those that are the causes and those that will transform the Princeton Institute, that will transform our lives and that will truly make us a whole people instead of one divided and labeled and compartmentalized. I'm so grateful for this medal. I will do my best to live up to it. And I would only say to each of us in this room that in this room, in this universe, that the art of behaving ethically and effectively is behaving as if everything we do matters. I used to use the image of a butterfly because I had heard a physicist say the flap of a butterfly's wing can change the weather hundreds of miles away, and I thought that was very inspiring. But even I, hopeaholic that I am, had to admit that it was a little saccharine as an image of change. So I went to learn about butterflies, and I understand the Institute has a scholar of butterflies at the moment, right? and I discovered that the actual change was much more complicated, that in the body of the caterpillar, there is something called, I think really called, imaginal cells. Isn't that a wonderful phrase? Imaginal cells. And those cells know how to become a butterfly, but need nourishment. It is the resistance between the activity of the cells and the body of the caterpillar wishing to remain in the same form. It is that friction and resistance that reduces the caterpillar to a gelatinous mass, as they say, that feeds the cells and that makes the butterfly possible. It is a much, much more realistic image of change. I hope that it makes us not afraid of friction, not afraid of being honest with each other, not afraid at looking at the big questions and the small. But what it tells us, it seems to me, is that each one of us in this room is an imaginal cell. And together, we make one world-changing butterfly. Thank you.